So just to remind everybody, we just had a very nice talk from Elliot. We probably don't need reminding about that. On an age-old question in astrophysics, which is, does the light trace the mass? Before that, we had a wonderful talk from Jeff with lots of new results on the intrinsic size of Sagittarius A star. Interesting contributions from Sarah on the on X-rays observations. Andrea talked to us about the survival of G2, among other matters. John gave us a overview of a raft of simulations, including MAD, SANE, and the zero equivalent nepotism models. Marta put it in context for us and argued that M87 was likely to be the product more of mergers than of accretion, whereas Sagittarius A star fell on the other end of the spectrum. And Shep gave us a wonderful overview of EHT. So do we have any questions from the group? Yeah, additional questions to start the discussion.
The last speaker. Yeah. What is electron skin depth in Sagittarius A disk? Yeah, and typical armor radius as well.
The question is, what is the electron skin depth? It's very small compared to the size of the horizon.
Yeah, but how small?
8 orders of magnitude, 9 orders of magnitude. I forget the exact number. So, very small.
So full scale, say peak simulations, are meaningless in this setup.
So I think the question is, so the right way to model the galactic center would be to not use a fluid approximation, but actually to do a full principles global plasma simulation. That's extraordinarily—
Even for two fluid, you need to resolve skin depth.
No, you don't.
You do.
Right, so two fluid, it's a two fluid MHD model. So that's what I meant by same density, same velocity, different thermodynamics.
Yeah,
so
if you want to do collisionless reconnection, for
correct.
Example, using two fluid models, you still need
yes.
to resolve the electron skin depth.
That's exactly right. So I think we still don't understand the saturation of the magnetorotational instability in local particle simulation. So I think that's the clear first step. And when we understand that better, then I think one will clearly never be able to do the right parameter regime for the galactic center, a plasma simulation, but one could hope to get correct the hierarchy of scales. So horizon larger than scale height, larger than skin depth.
I think this is a very fortuitous arrangement of speakers, and if we just got Sarah and Elliot to switch, it would very much be from the largest scales and outer boundary conditions that we're going to apply down to the smallest scales and where we have to start worrying a lot about particle acceleration. So one question I had was, a lot was made about understanding the boundary conditions at large scales, and yet we just heard that the chief uncertainty, at least according to Elliot, and certainly Sarah, and I don't think it's unique, is particle acceleration, these very high energy processes that are probably dominated by contributions very close in. So let me just throw out there, how much is what the EHT might see going to really depend upon those outer boundary conditions, and how much is just completely swamped by the local high energy processes? It's not really a question for anybody, just a—
Well, I mean, I think those are not separate issues, right? I mean, there's two things going on. You have the bulk properties, and things like the temperature and the magnetic field and all of the things that have to be put into your calculations are going to be determined by what's brought in from outside. I don't think that they're unconnected. But of course, then when you look at the small scale physics, that's going to be dominated by the stuff that's very close to the black hole. So I'm not sure that you can get away. The point I was trying to make, essentially, by saying that the Chandra outer boundary is important, is that once you have— I mean, we don't have the dynamic scales, Elliot and everyone is saying, to do a full-scale model, but you have to be able to connect these conditions that you fit to your models of the inner few Schwarzschild radii to what's happening at 10 to the 5 Schwarzschild radii. you have to know where these conditions are coming from. But I think for the sake of the EHT, you're mostly interested in the inner 5 to 10. For, I don't know if you want to add.
The simple thing is that roughly you have to know the global conditions. Elliot needs to know those global conditions to know whether there is turbulence, whether there is a jet, whether there is this funnel wall. So you need to know the magnetic fields from large distance, how they're built up, all these global constraints before you can actually start injecting anything.
I would also add, I don't think I said that electron physics was the only uncertainty. I think this question of what is the large-scale magnetic field structure is also extremely important. I think to the extent that we think the accretion is fed by stellar winds, it's not clear that much of the ambient magnetic flux in the galactic center that John rightly pointed is there actually can make its way down given the large ram pressure of the stellar wind. So it's possible, but I think we don't know, that that puts one in the sane limit. It would be really nice to be able to sort that out. I don't know if John has any thoughts on the extent to which the EHT type observations will actually help distinguishing between those models.
I guess if there was an obvious jet, that would help in Cetus A star, for example.
What I was struck by with the talks is this focus on turbulence. And what I wanted to point out to everyone and to the panel is that the time resolution of the EHT data is set to be very finely granular, very, very quickly. So when ALMA comes online, we anticipate getting sub 10-second closure phases. For example, which can trace spatial scales at the event horizon on very rapid time variations. Same thing with closure amplitudes. These are good observables. These are directly relatable in some sense to the power spectrum of the fluctuations you expect to see. So all these processes that give rise to this kind of turbulent spectrum, this time variable, can be directly observed. So if we can find a statistical way of teasing some physical variations out, that'd be very interesting.
I'm curious, on those timescales, what are the actual observables that you get out compared to what you see on the longer timescales? Yeah, I mean, on the 10-second timescale, what are you actually measuring compared to what's anticipated in terms of seeing, say, the photon ring? Or are they the same?
Well, the thing they start at VM over CQ is so short. You know there have to be some variations going on there.
Oh, I wouldn't have to.
Wait, please wait for the microphone.
I'm asking from an observational, not a theoretical.
Can you measure all the quantities you want on 10-second?
Oh, yeah, well, yeah, no, I'm sorry. You can't. So we couldn't measure, for example, we couldn't take snapshots on 10-second timescales. We couldn't get like an image of the shadow or something every 10 seconds and see it change. What you can do is you can get very very sensitive phase measurements as a function of time and see, a la that strip chart recording that I showed, something moving dynamically around Sag A star. But you know that's a very schematic model. If there's turbulence, you'll see statistical fluctuations in those closure phase measurements as a function of time. I think that's where the gold is.
Chef, can I ask a quick question? Yeah. So, I mean, the scale of that variability, is that ideal observing conditions? You know, because you're also going to have issues with correlating stuff and bad weather. I mean, would that be something you could see kind of boilerplate observation, or will that be ideal conditions?
The nice thing about these non-imaging data products is that you only need 3 stations. So there'll be many more times when you wind up having good weather at 3 stations or 4 stations, and ALMA will usually have good weather. So you get very high fidelity closure phase time series.
Okay, now I know how to.
I just want to come back to the question that Avery asked. I don't think it's as hopeless as it may have been sounding. And Monica will talk about this on Tuesday a little bit, doing exactly what you've been discussing with the funnel wall, right? And indeed, the structure of Set J star at lower frequencies look drastically different if you go, if you put the electrons hot in the jet or in the accretion disk. But luckily, at around 1 millimeter, there will be still differences, but they'll be smaller, right? So the GR is absolutely dominating at around 1 millimeter. So the parameters that you get out of a model will change somewhat, but it will not completely wash out all the structure. So I think that's good news. And then the other comment I want to make about the large-scale structure and the input to the Bondi-Hoyle simulations, I mean, as Sarah mentioned, there is the density from Chandra, but we also, from the magnetar, which is sort of Jeff sort of alluded to, we also have a measure of the magnetic field in that region, because it's a high rotation measure. We pretty much know what the magnetic field value is. It's a couple of milligauss. So we do have a problem which is not completely unconstrained, right? We have density, magnetic field, and so there will be some uncertainties, but I think we're not completely hopeless to go further.
That's a quick question for Ilya. So you showed one of the snapshot for thermal.
I think Ilya wanted to respond to that,
Not particularly. Again, I think the measurement in the magnetic field strength from the magnetar is not in the plasma that's going to fall onto the black hole. It's well outside that.
So I guess my comment on that is that even at the Bondi radius, you don't know that the flow is in rather than out.
Yeah. So I want to talk about something related to what Avery asked on the boundary condition question, but distinct from the intrinsic physics, which I think there's the propagation physics of what we see. And I actually think that the result from Carl Gwynn seeing the image in the average image domain and seeing that they're essentially speckles that haven't been averaged down. And the fact that it looks like the impact of those speckles may be increasing as we go to shorter frequencies suggests that there's really a lot we don't understand about the scattering regime and that we need to understand. And both the magnetar and now this domain of being able to look at the average image and characterize its time scale and its amplitude and its frequency dependence are very powerful.
Can I ask a yes-no question? Is that unique to Sag J star? Is it only in Sag J star where we can do that observation?
I do not think it has been seen in other sources, although I would have to go back. It's possible that Cygnus X3, which was investigated by Narayan and Peter Wilkinson around the time of the Narayan and Goodman paper, I think they may have seen the average image domain long baseline detections.
Quick question for Elliot. You showed the images for pure thermal and pure power law distributions. I don't know what frequency that was at, but does the power law size violate the observed constraint of the image size? So it has to be mostly kind of quasi-thermal. Okay, that's what you used. I see.
Okay, and we had a question. But
that's also clear from the infrared data, right? I mean, if you had a big power law, you'd have trouble hiding it. So.
Okay, I'd like to go back to the comment by Jonathan that it would be really nice if we knew that Sag J had a jet. And I took the core shift data that Jeff showed as pretty good evidence for jets. Am I overinterpreting or?
I wish I could say that it meant that there's a jet. The measurement,
but there could be.
There could be. The measurement is consistent with zero, so that means it could either be a jet or some symmetric arrangement, but it's also consistent with the model. But we have the potential, so that's the average measurement over a year and a half of observing the pulsar. Individual measurements where we have two frequencies at the same time give values that are non-zero. Now the question is that due to refractive effects or due to systematic errors in our calibration that we don't understand, or is it real source effects? And those you know, that you might recall from that graph, those values are kind of all over the place. So, but we have the potential to get at this and do better with it, and we'll focus on that over the next couple of years, provided the magnetar stays bright.
Okay, Stefan.
Yeah, I have a question, I think, for Jonathan. So all what I've seen seems like that the geometry of the accretion flow seems to be consistent with the orientation of the stellar disk. That what I get from Sarah's talk and also from your recent observations. The disk is 6 mega-years old, and my question is that enough time that the spin axis of such a star already has reacted to that? So can we predict the spin axis, the jet axis, or is it simply not enough and it's a random?
Not for the low accretion luminosity, accretion rate that's in Centaurus A star.
So for M87, we have core shift measurements as well. We have better core shift measurements, and those core shift measurements are actually a great way to probe the magnetic field strength at the black hole. So if we were to get a good core shift measurement for Sagittarius A star, we could do the same thing. And we could then compare that magnetic field strength that we get to what we expect in these magnetically arrested disk models and see if we get to the limit of what we can stuff into the black hole magnetic flux-wise. It seems like for M87, we actually are at that limit. So that's quite exciting. And for other about 60 or so radio-loud AGN, so it sounds like a lot of these AGN with strong jets want to be at that limit. And we will hopefully soon see if Sagittarius A star wants to be there as well.
We have a jet. We have a much weaker jet, so it's a much harder observational problem.
Okay, Sarah, how about?
Well, I'd have a little note about this, and actually, I think Riley has this in his poster. But if you compare Sag A star to other sources, I mean, it really isn't that much of an outlier. And there's this thing called the fundamental plane of black hole accretion, which is basically a relationship between the mass of the black hole, the radio emission, and the X-ray emission. And Sag A star, it's interesting, when it's flaring, which is when you see the same non-thermal processes that you see in other AGN X-ray binaries, it basically sits on the same arrangement. And when it's not flaring, you can't tell because the X-ray emission is really non-thermal stuff from outer boundary, and it hides what's happening close to the black hole. So the point is, I think Sag A star, you know, in every single way that we can look at, looks like it should have a jet, just a weak jet. We know from the scattering screen it'd be very hard to see. So, I mean, I'm still a believer. And it's nice finally that the EHT community, it seems like people are starting to be interested in this as well, because it would of course bring a nice comparison to M87, but I think there's so much evidence piling up that you would say is indirect that it's hard to almost argue why would it be so unique compared to all other black holes.
I think there's a fundamental difference. Galactic center is sitting in a spiral galaxy, and in a spiral galaxy, the angular momentum is far out in the spiral arms. In M87, you have a gigantic elliptical galaxy where all the angular momentum has been transported to the center. So I'm not convinced that Sagittarius must have a jet. In fact, I'm more convinced like this is a low accretion flow thing, and the other thing, M87, is a high accretion flow thing. So most likely, the accretion flow itself drives the presence of a jet.
In X-ray binaries, we see jets going down to 10^-8 Eddington luminosity, exactly like Sagittarius A star. There's no evidence that any physics changes from 10^-3 in terms of the ability to launch jets. So I think, you know, the argument about spin and angular momentum, you know, we see different radio loud and radio quiet states also in X-ray binaries. There's a real question about the role of these outer environment and spin and things like that, and really what's happening in the inner 100 Schwarzschild radii that seems to be quite the same for black holes across all mass fields.
I agree, in principle I agree, but what makes radio loudness and radio quietness? So that's something which we don't understand. Of course, there are now new paper around which come up with the same ideas as 20 years ago, but now the idea is basically let's have a magnetic field which is there that produces radio loudness. I mean, radio loudness means in presence of synchrotron radiation. How do you generate synchrotron radiation? Of course, with lots of electrons and a lot of magnetic field. in principle, perhaps it's really the magnetic field which drives the difference, or the combination of magnetic field and spin. But I have one more question with regard, or one plea, actually, with regard to the theoreticians who model that. At the moment, these models are very, very detailed and really amazingly good, but we need to ask us, how can we discriminate between the models as observers? The EHT is still a very small VLBI array. It can measure sizes. It eventually, in the next year, with more stations, will provide images with sufficient fidelity. We have to accept that the fidelity in the beginning will be of order of 100 to 1 or so, not 1,000 to 1. So what I would ask as an observer is, when you do your model simulations, make predictions how sizes change with frequency and how fluxes change with frequency. That is easy to measure. So for example, with regard to M87 and the core sheath spine structure, an important question to ask would be, what's the spectral index of the sheath? Is it flat, steep, or inverted? That's something which we can measure extremely easily. Then the other thing is, what is the kinematics? I mean, what kind of jet speeds would you expect in M87? M87 is subluminal, but it has measurable speeds, and that will cause a new problem. We will have to do very often repeated observations. We will need to make movies at 1 millimeter. And that, of course, is not so easy, but in principle, the time scale of variability of these sources is of the order of weeks to maybe in the galactic center, of course, much faster, but for AGN, it's of order of several days to weeks. So we have to have a cadence of 100 images over a time scale of half a year. And that is something which I think is really a big challenge, which we cannot meet at the moment, but we could try in sort of burst epochs. For let's say a week or two, get really dense and time sampled images in order to measure the velocity distribution in AGN. In M87, Shep of course can't do the imaging because he has to just do time series analysis of the closure phases because the time scales are so terribly short. But in M87 and other more distant objects, we have about 2,000 times longer gravitational time scale. So that happens, things happen on a time scale of a week. So basically, I think what we need is to convince the ALMA community to give us that observing time. That's a big problem.
Okay, thank you. Any comments on that?
Well, I'm just going to make a brief comment on that for Sajay Star, there's a lot of good work going on now to overcome the time variability question. So there are ways to average in the UV plane, the baseline plane, and to employ these deconvolution techniques to get images in the face of GRMHD turbulence and GRMHD evolution of the accretion. But I wanted to ask, before we lose this train, I wanted to ask the other panel here, it's very important for Sajay Star especially to be able to see through the scattering. And what we've been doing so far, this has been led by Vincent Fish and Michael Johnson and others, is to deconvolve, knowing the scattering, but extrapolating that scattering down to the highest frequencies. Now, this is scattering that is going to hold very close to the event horizon. It affects the event horizon imaging. So, is there any problem with extrapolating what we know from 20 centimeters, 2 centimeters, 1 centimeter, all the way down to let's say 0.87 millimeter wavelength? Are there any processes we don't know about? Is there anything that's going to bite us, or is that a good extrapolation to make so we can deconvolve things?
So the slide that I skipped over was estimates of refractive time scales. And so at 7 millimeters, an order of magnitude estimate is a few months. But that's sort of the minimum time scale on which the scattering, the turbulent material moves a beam width. But the image has remained stable for 20 years. It hasn't changed at all. And then if you look at the pulsar, and you say the pulsar's got exactly the same scattering as Sajay Star, and it's a tenth of a parsec away, now you're looking at hundreds of years as the minimum time scale for the scattering to change. Now that's a big extrapolation to say that, but it does look like it's coherent over that scale. With that said, though, I come back to this average image domain, and those are times that those time scales, those refractive time scales, are time scales for a 100% change. Now, what is the time scale for a 1% change or a 10% change? And we really don't know. And I think that this average image domain is potentially very useful for going after that.
Okay, so Demetrius.
I wanted to respond to Thomas for a moment about the idea that that we should be producing predictions straight off from all of the simulations we saw today. The message that I come away with when I see this is that there's still a lot of fundamental physics that needs to be constrained before there can be a canonical model that we can say, and now we measure A, B, C, and D from this. And that there's going to be, you know, if we were to try to take those and immediately start analyzing EHT data, we'd run the risk of badly overinterpreting what we've got. And so what we really need to do as a community is sit down and identify the robust features that are independent of things like how many non-thermal electrons you have, what is the morphology, how can we generically distinguish between morphologies, things like global things that are going to survive those particulars, and then provide those. But the great news is that as a project, I think we're going to progress to the point where we're going to answer these in increasing detail.
I wanted to go back to the scattering issue, and I mean the timescales that you mentioned are very important, but there is another issue that we usually don't pay attention to, and that is the 2-to-1 ratio in the scattering ellipse is actually very, very bad as far as, you know, we're concerned with extrapolating. If it was isotropic, it would have been trivial. Everything scales as lambda squared. But 2-to-1 ratio is too small to be MHD turbulence, like Goldreich's radar turbulence. It could have been 10, 30, 50. And the only way that you can make it down to 2-to-1 ratio is by having the magnetic field tumbling around in the scattering screen, both in the line of sight and in the tangential direction. And you average out to make about 2-to-1 ratio. The problem going from 20 centimeters to a millimeter is that the refractive length scales increases by 10 to the 5, and the area increases by 10 to the 10, or decreases when you extrapolate. So as the area changes by a factor of 10 to the 10, you expect that the tumbling of the magnetic field does not change, the power in the, you know, in the variability of the magnetic field does not change, which is extremely unlikely. So chances are that we're going to expect some deviation of the 2-to-1 ratio and some wandering of the position angle of the scattering when you go from 10, 20 centimeters to a millimeter. And the only way to do that is make a, you know, model for the scattering based on the underlying turbulence and then try to fit the data, which is, I mean, I'll say something about that on Wednesday, but that's something we're trying to
do. Or we could try to image the magnetar at like 0.2 millimeters.
We've already measured it accurately from 20 centimeters to 7 millimeters, right? And so there, that's 10 to the 3. And no, both directions. Not the intrinsic size, but the scattering size. Yes, we have. Sure. There are errors, but it's not at nowhere is it, you know, is it 30 to 1 or 10 to 1, right? It's 0.5 plus or minus 0.1.
Okay, we're up to lunchtime. Why don't we thank our morning speakers again.